Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Have you sat back over the last 2 decades and thought about the sheer number of fatalities surrounding this case?
Can I tell you a secret?
That you been killing.
What happened?
Those kids. My kids. Why? My whole brain's a bunch of missing pieces. That's when it all started. Panic.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching True Detective. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us for the first time, what we do on this show is each week we go through the latest episode of True Detective and we sort of dig through theories and the latest twists. We go through your emails and we usually have an interview with someone from the cast. This week we have the great Michael Gray Eyes, who plays Brett Woodard on the show. And we will only be spoiling up through season 3, episode 4, The Hour of the Man, written by David Milch and Nick Pizzolatto, directed by Nick Pizzolatto. I just want to let you guys know off the top of the show, though, that there's a compelling theory floating around that I think is somewhere between a spoiler and not. So we decided to do kind of what we did with Sharp Objects, with like book knowledge from Sharp Objects, if you listen to that miniseries that we did, which is put conversation about this theory at the end of the episode. So you can just, there'll be an audio cue for you to leave, and you can decide for yourself whether or not you want to like interact with this particular theory. So that is coming up at the end of the episode, as well as that interview with Brett Woodard. But before we do that, we want to get to some of your emails. The first, and of course, obviously most important email is our man on the street, our woman on the street in Fayetteville, Arkansas, responded to our request for the best burger in Arkansas. Are you ready, Richard?
Oh, I'm always ready for a burger. Yes.
All right. So this is from Peyton, and Peyton says the best burger in Fayetteville, Arkansas is a place called Hugo's, which was actually featured in episode 2, where 1990s Wayne met, the John Tenney character and learned a bit about Julie's, like the whole print, the whole fingerprint scene and all of that. So, and she said that Marshall Ali's Grill and Chill at the Devil's Den being a close second. So there you go. If you're in Fayetteville, Arkansas and you need a burger, you want to go to Hugo's. Hopefully we will not ruin the burger business at Hugo's just by saying that on this podcast.
If you're on the inevitable True Detective Season 3 location tour.
Right. Yes.
Which
yes.
I'm sure people are going to want to do. Let's go to the cave.
And then we've got a couple other theories. One person, Lauren wrote in to really wanted to zero in on who Julie's real dad might be. This is something we might touch on this episode, but like if we want to believe Tom's mom, that Tom is Purcell is not the real father of Julie Purcell, then we need to ask some questions about who Julie's real dad might be. Is it someone that Lucy worked with at the bar? Is it someone that Lucy worked with at Hoyt Foods? Like, who would Lucy be running around with that might be Julie's real father? But what Lauren says is it ain't Scoot. So we'll see if we agree with Lauren on that front. Do you have any Julie daddy theories?
Well, I mean, the Hoyt thing with the food, the bag in hidden away, like that, I feel like that, like, I feel like, you know, in a series that is partly about predatory men, like, wouldn't it make sense that some, like, more powerful person at her place of work, and then just she left and she kind of brushed it off. It's like, well, I make more tips at the restaurant. Like, maybe there was something more involved there.
Yeah. So Julie from Vancouver also wrote in about this same topic, and, she pointed out that in the documentary 2015, interaction, the director, Eliza, says what happened with Julie and her father rather than Julie and Tom. And Julie from Vancouver writes, I think it's because Tom isn't Julie's father, which they've alluded to already. So I don't think something happened between Julie and Tom. I think she came back to confront her real father, or her real father went after her. Who could her father be? I feel like it has to be someone we've met already. I think it's someone in law enforcement. I think that's who's been messing with the case. There have been multiple mentions of officers showing up to question people and that information not being shared or tips not being followed up on. My guess is the higher up cop who released information in the press conference. I think is less likely, but still possible, one of the prosecutors reopening the case, or Roland West. Okay. I'm saying I don't want it to be Stephen Dorff. That's the only thing that I care about. I don't want it to be Roland, but like the attorney general is not the worst theory I've ever heard. Kent, he's doing some terrible things. I think in this episode, we might get some compelling question marks around the idea of it being Cousin Dan, which just adds a nice little like extra incest twist to the whole thing. So why not do that? And then there's the last thing that I'm going to email. I'm going to read. I'm going to save for that sort of spoiler section where you do at the end. So there's some great emails we got. We got a whole bunch of great emails. So thank you. Keep sending them in. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And the last thing I'm going to say before we do our little like beat by beat thing is that this week we're going to try to keep our heads straight with what's going on. But instead of bouncing back and forth in time, we're going to take the 1980, the 1990, and the 2015 and do them sort of one by one. You know, cause
yeah, the main show is like, you know, like kind of confusing enough with the fractured timelines. Yeah. For a recap show, maybe we could try to streamline that.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to start, where else in 1980, where everyone's hair is a little higher and more voluminous, with this whole church plot line. What do you think of this church storyline that runs through the episode, Richard?
Well, I mean, look, if you're telling a story about, you know, malfeasance done toward kids, perhaps by some sort of institutional sinister power, can you really not talk about the Catholic Church?
Right. Fair
at
enough.
This point,
fair
I enough. Mean, no real offense meant to Catholic listeners out there, but like, come on. Like, I'm from Boston. I grew up right near the Archdiocese. Like, that is now, I mean, you know, that is a part of Catholic culture, honestly. So, or at least the clerical culture. So, yeah, I mean, it felt kind of inevitable that we'd get there at some point.
Yeah. So we find out a few, I think the most important clue, I guess, that we get from the priest, and the priest also being a suspect, of course, is this idea of an aunt, that Julie was excited about seeing an aunt. And we see a note card on the cork board later, the investigation cork board, that says new aunt question mark. So, Julie and Will don't have an aunt. So who
right.
is this woman? Is she the same white woman that has been mentioned a couple times, like lurking around the neighborhood and stuff like that? So.
Right. And so this is, I think, this episode, interesting, you know, maybe it's a short-lived theory. My sort of Amelia theory about she's the one who did it because she wanted fodder for her book kind of starts to break down in this episode. Because, you know, the aunt thing is interesting because you're like, well, that could be Amelia. It could be the other woman. But we see in another scene in the 1980 section when they go to talk to this old lady who makes the dolls for the church.
Right.
Where he's like, was he good looking, not ugly? She's like, well, I mean, he was black. And so I think that there would be such a distinction made by people in this community if a black woman said, I'm, or no, but no, they didn't see the aunt, did they? Or did he meet her?
The priest didn't. There's been like a.
Oh, okay. So never mind then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it could be someone that they call an aunt, and I could see them like giving Amelia that, you know.
And maybe she just mentioned my aunt blank. Okay. Yeah. So that the Amelia theory survives that.
Right.
I don't think it survives some stuff, as well, later in the episode.
But that whole Patty Faber interaction, the woman who makes the Cornhusk dolls, I really enjoyed because like there's this whole lead up to it. You know, the priest calls her a dear good woman. You know, Hayes says sort of skeptically and ironically, like, can't wait to meet Patty Faber, a dear good woman. And then she's just like, she's another like the farmer, but a little more the farmer we met last week. Just like, you know, this racism that Wayne has to deal with all the time, where he's like, anything else you could tell us about the guy's face? Was he like ugly? Handsome? She's like, I don't know, he was black, that's all I got. Like, he lives, I assume he lives over where you people live across the tracks, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then she just like gives this look to him as he leaves her house, which is just like this, I think the actress really nailed this like racist white woman trying not to look racist, but also being very scared without having any real reason to be scared, look on her face. It's really a beautiful scene there of disgusting racism. So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it's the show being both subtle and overt, you know, with these kind of themes. Like, I think that this is not... The chief theme of this season isn't necessarily a black police officer in a bigoted community trying to, you know, rescue two white children or you know, avenge one white child and rescue another. But it's definitely, it has to be part of the landscape. You know, it has to be part of the fabric of the world and of the show. So I think that scenes like this, where maybe it's a little bit on the nose, but I appreciate that they're not forgetting that, you know.
Yeah, well, I think we mentioned before that Mahershala Ali's character, Wayne, was supposed to be, was not written as black. And yeah, that Mahershala Ali had to, like, convince Nick Pizzolatto to cast him. And so all of this stuff has been sort of seeded back in, but it all works. It doesn't seem, like, super overt. And we should also mention that this episode and a few other episodes, or at least like parts of other episodes, were co-written by David Milch this season. Usually Nick Pizzolatto has all the writing credits on a season of True Detective. David Milch of Deadwood fame was brought in to, you know, their conflicting reports as to why David Milch was brought in. David Milch was brought in because season two wasn't very good. David Milch was brought in because Nick Pizzolatto asked for help. Who knows, like, exactly why he's there? Always welcome in my mind, because, like, if anything, Deadwood is known for its absolutely exquisite dialogue. And so, you know, any sort of, like, beautiful turns of phrases. I mean, True Detective obviously already had a reputation for beautiful dialogue, but, you know, there's a possibility that there are some Milchian turns of phrases in here. And we should also mention that David Milch had this, like, a mentorship or something like that, some connection to Robert Penn Warren. So all the Robert Penn Warren poems we saw earlier this season might have been, like, a Milchian kind of touch, even though they seem Pizzolattoian as well. So
yeah, you can hear the Milch in this episode, though.
Yeah.
Like, I think, like, in the dinner scene between Amelia and Wayne.
Yeah.
In the fight scene between Amelia and Wayne in the 1990 storyline. Just these kind of curly Q kind of, you know, bits that, like, True Detective has had in the past, but they have a kind of extra sort of ornateness to them in this episode, which I don't mind. I mean, I'm somebody who, like, has tried several times to watch Deadwood, and I just do not speak that show's language. Like, I really don't understand what they're saying most of the time. And so I just think that my brain has a block for it. Like, John from Cincinnati, that another show that was, like, I had no idea what was going on in the show. Was Luck him too? The horse racing show?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Again, like, so I don't speak Milchian, but here, when it's blended with Pizzolatto, like, I can appreciate his high style without getting lost, which, you know, so I appreciated the blend.
Yeah, so I agree with you that he's got that extra pepper. There's this, I don't even want to call it vulgarity, like, maybe carnality. Like, there's a lot of talk of fucking in this episode, right? And so, like, yeah, especially between Wayne and Amelia. And so, like, that is something that Milch does really well. You're so right to call it out. This carnality that is not vulgar, it is, like, human and grounded in, like, you know, feelings that we all recognize. And that's something that Milch is perfect at. So there we go. We get, Hayes and West following up on this, like, following the trail of this man with a dead eye, who bought a whole bunch of Cornhusk dolls. And that idea of, like, a man with a dead eye or a man with a scar matches up with that whole report we learned about earlier, where just, like, a white woman and a man with a scar were, like, lurking around doing things. So, you know, they might be on the right track here. And as we should mention really quickly, as they go into Davis Junction, which I guess is the black section of this area, they drive past a marquee that says, "You do not know the day nor the hour," which just gives this episode its title, The Hour of the Day. I think I called it The Hour of the Man earlier by accident. Anyway, which is a Bible quote from Matthew. And it just sort of means, like, you don't know when Jesus is coming, so keep an eye out for him. Do you have any, like, thoughts on what, I was thinking of Cometh the Hour, Cometh the Man, but it's you do not know the day or the hour. Do you have any thoughts on that, Richard, and what, how that might apply to this story?
I mean, I'm pretty bad with like religious illusion, to be honest, even though I've gone to Catholic school and stuff. But like, you know, I think it, you know, we were using the word hour and last episode, Wayne and Amelia had this kind of conversation about naming time and all that stuff. So there's something about, and all the memory stuff is coming to play. So there's something about like, presence, you know, and your sense of tense, you know, that I think is maybe being alluded to there, but I could be totally wrong.
Oh, I like that. I do know we have at least one listener, who is like super fluent in studying the Bible, who wrote in a lovely email to us about, I had mentioned last week that Tom's, prayer sounded a little like slightly extreme in its language last week. And this listener pointed out to me that it is actually fairly standard, sort of like 12 steppy language. And so, you know, I take that correction well. And if that listener has any thoughts on this quote, I would really welcome them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're following the track through a liquor store. There's great dialogue throughout this episode. You know, Wayne's like, we're going to a liquor store that to look for a black suspect. That's racist. And Roland's like, it's one of three businesses in this town. Like, that's where we're going to start. And then we have this really explosive interaction at the trailer park, which sort of presages the explosive racially charged interaction that we have at the end of this episode, between this, you know, man with the dead eye, Roland, Wayne, and all the people who live in the trailer park. And like, what's interesting about the scene, you know, set in 19, as it is in 1980, is it reminds me so much of like a lot of what we've seen, lately with, you know, Black people across the country or, you know, anyone who feels sort of targeted across the country using their cell phones as like a defense mechanism against mm-hmm. like, you know, police aggression. You know, this guy doesn't have that. So he's like calls all the people in his community to be like, watch these people. They're trying to pin something on me. Keep a watchful eye. What did you think of this scene?
Yeah. I mean, it was tense and I think it's just, you know, it's an interesting look at, another community within this broader town where so much of the story is focused on, you know, well, he says like, must be white kids if it was in the newspaper,
mm-hmm.
you know, so here are these members of this town, or, you know, nearby town, broader community, whatever, who, you know, are ever present and observing of what's going on and, you know, know enough to see this car coming in and knowing that it's police and knowing it's bad. And yet I think, well, either it's a fault of the show that these characters are not more central to the world building or deliberate, you know, where it's like, there are whole other narratives happening over here that like people are just not paying attention to, even Wayne. I think in terms of just fleshing out, what this place is and what tensions animate it. I think this is a kind of a crucial scene, you know, if the season's going to be partly or indirectly or whatever about, the uneasy dynamic of race in this part of the country and any part of this country. You know, this is the kind of vital thing, you know, we have to see. And it was happening long before, the current, protest movements, that, you know, have gotten so much attention.
Absolutely. Of course. And like this scene is so telling for Wayne's character in terms of, you know, like he gets confronted by this man. Whitehead is the name of this man. And he is confronted by this man, who says like, how can you wear this badge? And Wayne has this great retort, which is like, it's got a little clip on it. Like that's a great little zinger. But this scene highlights the way in which Wayne as a cop is rejected by this black community. Right. And then the way Wayne as a black man is rejected by the cop community by and large, like Roland being an exception, you know, it like Wayne just doesn't have a home. He doesn't have a place, you know? And so, yeah, that's really underlined in this interaction. I think we do get an important detail, which, you know, this guy who says he's innocent, he points out that like, lot of black men in the area have like scars and missing eyes and missing limbs and missing digits because of both farm work. And he mentions the killing line at the chicken plant. So he mentions Hoyt Farms sort of basically in that scene. So
we're getting a picture that this industry, much like the hog processing plant in Sharp Objects, looms large over the economy of this town, you know? And so what that does is distill the suspect pool to, you know, because you can be like, oh, wait, like, the bag and the chicken plant. And it's like, right, but like, a lot of people work there.
Right, exactly.
Like, many people in the town. And so when you have single industry or, you know, kind of mono industry towns like that, like, it's not that people are indistinct because they all work at the same place, but it just sort of, you know, it sort of muddies the waters of trying to find one person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And so then we hop from that, from like, you know, their car gets wrecked. Wayne asks Roland if they could just like call it, like, I forget what he says, but Roland's response is, oh, we're not going with irate Negroes, which is just like, once again, kind of beautifully delivered by Stephen Dorff. Like, I admire everything that Dorff does in this episode and generally in this show. He's fantastic, as is Marshla, obviously. And speaking of which, we're gonna do a little 1-2 punch of like love stories, because, you know, though it's a passing thing in this episode, we see Roland eyeballing one of the women who goes to this church, a prisoner there. She's played by an actress, Jodie Balfour, who was great, in my opinion, as Jackie Kennedy on season 2 of The Crown. And like, I'm just saying, Jodie Balfour doesn't show up for one scene to walk by. So
probably not. Yeah.
We're probably going to see this woman that Roland has his eye on again. And then we get Wayne and Amelia's on their first date. And this is where you said you've really felt like the Milchian pepper coming through.
I mean, it has this kind of like glide to it, and it's sort of, you know, they're talking cute, you know, like it's almost Mammoth-y in a way too, which Milch and Mammoth are, you know, share a lot of DNA. But it's not kind of, it doesn't feel too presentational. It does feel like two smart people talking, real people. And I just love the way that scene kind of shifts and undulates, and it's not exactly they're sort of negotiating a power dynamic. I think they're just, they're two relatively reserved people who are trying to say at a nice restaurant in a sort of like eager but also kind of high-minded way as possible that like, I'm really into you.
Yeah, I love that. But also you mentioned the undulations, and I think that's a really good word. I feel like it shifts, continually shifts in the way that first dates often do, between like, we're both on the same page and we're interested in each other, to like awkwardness and, oh, did I misjudge this? And, oh, shit, am I the only one into this? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like we see that dynamic, which just feels so true, even though I don't think any of us has ever talked about, like, murder necessarily on our first date. But I don't,
well,
I mean,
you know, look, you don't, I mean, I'm not going to go into my personal life, but.
All right, Richard, whatever you did to get Ben Barnes, I approve. That's all I have to say. But
I killed his girlfriend. We had to talk about it on the date.
But there's a great moment of comedy where like Wayne says this thing about like fucking and murdering kids, like in front of the waitress. And that's like maybe the most like deeply awkward part.
Yeah, and what he says is a lot of these people think there's affection even up to the fucking and killing them part, which is such a blunt way to put that, you know, and I think we see, especially in this episode, probably maybe it, like you mentioned, the Milchi kind of carnality and all that, is that like, there has to be some roughness in Wayne because of his experience in Vietnam, you know? that where like there has to be where moments where he just kind of sees humanity as this very base thing.
Yeah.
And even though now he's sort of gentler and more haunted and, you know, he's a smart guy and likes to talk to Amelia about philosophical things in his sort of, you know, laconic way, like there is something else kind of in him, you know, whether it's in threatening people with prison rape or sort of letting slide the kind of crudest way possible to talk about this case, you know, on a date.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And I think obviously like the 2015 storyline bears up, that interpretation of, you know, like, let's not forget his vet status. And there's, the other thing, you know, maybe like, I'm not ready to like put your Amelia theory to bed entirely because I'm so enamored of it. And even if we might talk about things at the end of this episode that seem to belie it, I just want to say, if we want to keep the Amelia theory on the table, this idea comes up again throughout this episode, as we've seen before, that she uses sex as a distraction. Like in the scene when she's talking to him, he asks about her family and then she like basically pivots to sex pretty quickly from there and doesn't answer him about her family. And then she does it again later when they're fighting in 1990, you know,
and her saying, "I used to be a mess." Like we're just getting these little snippets that like she's not, I mean, she talked about the hotel thing and pretending to be another person, but these idea and the Black Panther stuff out in California. Not that there was anything bad about being part of the Black Panthers, but I just mean that like she has a past and that she wasn't always this kind of like ethereal school teacher, this earthy kind of, you know, warm presence. You know, so I'm curious. I just don't think they'd be dropping that for no reason. But, you know, this is also a show that just likes to kind of embellish its style. You know, it likes to kind of pad out its world, even if not everything is directly causal or consequential to the murder at hand.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, if we want to see Amelia as someone who's trying to lead the case from like the back seat, you know, she says all this leading stuff to him, like, which could be an investigative mind at work, or it could be her wanting to point him to certain conclusions. So she says, like, doesn't the way the bodies pose like denote affection, don't you think? Is something that she says, which is just classic leading, like to end something with like, don't you think? Like, I know you would have come up with this on your own, but I'm just going to like plant the seed for you sort of thing. So, so that is Amelia and Wayne's first date. And it all runs from there. On the like less cheery love angle, we get, you know, Tom, a complete wreck at the bar where Lucy works. He's been beat up and he's basically gone there to confront her boss, who I guess Lucy was having an affair with, according to Tom. The boss does not seem to deny it in any way. And then the boss called Roland to come pick Tom up. And this, if you know, this feels like an answer to questions we had last week about like, what is the connection between Tom and Roland? And, you know, what winds up happening is Roland picks Tom up, you know, gets him in the car and then basically like offers Tom a place to sleep on his couch. You know, and so this might be when Tom says, like, you pulled me out of that hole 10 years ago. Like, this might be the moment that he's talking about. Like, this is rock bottom for him and it's all up from here, or there's further to fall and Roland will be there for him. Again, you know,
and this is the first mention in this episode of three mentions, of people with suicidal ideation. He says, I just want to die later. Maybe Gummer's character,
Lucy
says, you know, I have a little 38 snub nose or whatever in my purse. And it's just, I need that last little bit of courage. And then in the 2015 segment, we see, you know, Wayne sitting with the gun on the desk thinking, maybe I don't want to live without my wife. So there are a lot of people, there are three people in this episode who have reached some sort of brink and yet don't quite cross it, at least not yet.
Well, yeah. And it's like Tom, it feels like Tom comes back from that edge and we find out that Lucy doesn't, because we find out this episode that she died of an overdose in Las Vegas. So it wasn't like she died peacefully in her sleep. Like she OD'd. She never comes out of that hole. You know what I mean? And Tom maybe did, as of 1990 did. We don't know if he'll stay that way because there's some indication that stuff happened. More shit went down for him in 1990 possibly. But, and then there's also this interaction where Tom drops the N-word, the N-bomb, and like genuinely from my view, like seems remorseful for using it. And like this interaction between Roland and Tom, I thought was really interesting because like 99% of the people that we met in Fayetteville, like or in Arkansas, I would not believe them if they like apologized for using the N-word. And like Tom, I actually genuinely do. And I don't know if that's just down to Scoot's performance or what, but it's.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's also saying that like a lot of the people, if not all of the white people in this town or this part of the country, this part of Arkansas, may have been steeped in that language and know that it's, you know, even if they don't feel, you know, racist in their hearts, like it's still a part of their worldview, you know? And in a time of despair or anger, it's the cruelest thing they can hurl out, you know? And I think there's obviously remorse, on Tom's part, less so. I think we can infer on Lucy's when she, you know, hurls some stuff at Amelia. So yeah, I don't know. There was a little small part of me that felt that scene drunk in the car. Well, I've seen like the grieving parent a lot in The Killing and so many other shows that I'm a little kind of sick of the sort of rhythms of that, but also like maybe it's a little bit Pizzolatto and I guess by extension Milch kind of exonerating themselves from some other racially charged language that's thrown around in the show.
Yeah. Know? It could be. Yeah, that's sort of like, I mean, Deadwood is entirely that, right? Deadwood has more racial epithets than you've ever heard in your entire life. Racial, like I learned 200 new racial epithets from Deadwood that I'd never heard in my life. But at the same time, like the best characters in the show have progressive attitudes towards race. Yes. So it's like you're having your cake and eating it too, sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I shouldn't say racially charged. They're racist words. They're outright racist words. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So let's skip straight to Lucy then, speaking of racist words and her interaction with Amelia, which is like maybe Gummer doing some great work here.
Probably her last episode, I would bet.
I would guess. You know, she,
maybe not.
She says, you know, she is the soul of a whore is sort of like how she opens and it just goes from there.
Sounds like Milch.
It's true. She says, the children should laugh, is something that she says to Amelia, which is, either her quoting the ransom note, or just unconsciously using the same language as the ransom note. And then she says this thing like that you mentioned that she wished she had the courage to kill herself. Where's that last bit of courage? She goes, the line reading that Mamie Gummer here does when she goes, where's that courage come from? Ooh, beautiful. Excellent. Yeah. Almost as good as everything you touch turns to shit. And then she says terrible things to Amelia. She calls her pickaninny. She says, you're a snooty cunt. And I wrote like woof in all caps in the show notes because I was just like, really? You know, and then you just get this tight on Amelia's face as she walks out and deals with that. So what did you think of like possibly Mamie Gummer's last scene?
I think it's a really, you know, it's as you know, a lot of grieving parent stuff is that my daughter in there, like that sort of scene or that sort of tone can risk emoting, you know, being a little big, but, I think she keeps it in check. And you know, I think it's, I don't know. It's an interesting Amelia scene too. I mean, obviously Lucy has the kind of big explosive stuff to do, but Amelia's a cool customer.
Yeah.
You know, and she's sitting there. Well, but she's not as cool as she thinks she is because Lucy picks right up on it, you know, but like I don't think she gives a shit about that woman. Like she's just there to sort of insinuate herself yet again in this because she likes it, you know, and maybe there is some empathy for it, but like, her motive was on her list of motives. I think comforting Lucy in any way was pretty low.
Yeah, I'm going to take these, you know, possessions, not out of the goodness of my heart, but because I want to like get info from her or encourage her to talk to Wayne.
These kind of like triggering possessions that she's maybe not even ready to look at and that she didn't necessarily even know existed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a plate that says, I love mom on it. And it's like, Jesus Christ, like the lady's kids, well, one died and one went missing like not that long ago. Like maybe wait.
Yeah, absolutely.
But she couldn't wait because she had to get, you know,
she had to be in the mix. That's Amelia. Yeah. So yeah, she's not a complete, you know, like this is when she talks about like playing different characters, you know, to Wayne in episode 2 or whatever. This is a character she's playing. The concerned school teacher is a character for Amelia is how I feel about it. So, And then we get to, let's do the whole Kenny Burns thing real quick. Like, Kenny Burns, one of the three teens in the purple VW, his prints kicked on the bike. We already saw him riding that bike, so we're not that surprised. But that's an excuse enough for, you know, Weston Hayes to pull him into interrogation. Wayne says some, like, truly terrible things about prison rape again to him. And we see the other two boys are also in interrogation before the detectives get called away. Anything you want to say about this scene?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because Wayne does say at another point in the episode that they're, like, fairly convinced that the person is connected to that church somehow. And, like, we don't know, we assume with his, like, you know, Black Sabbath shirts and everything that Kenny's not a devout churchgoer or whatever.
Right.
So, like, I kind of wonder, like, how much Wayne really believes, and Roland even really believes, that these kids are involved, but, like, I guess they just have to follow everything. And I think it was more to scare him, to get him to say anything else that he knew about, you know, what he saw. I really don't think that Wayne thinks he did it.
Right. We talked about, like, the true crime, the real crime associations with these three, but I think in every way they're a red herring for this story. That's how I feel about them.
Yeah.
You know, I could be wrong. And then we get to the, you know, the final act of 1980, which is the Brett Woodard interaction. We see him talking to these girls. He wants, like, to, you know, he asks them for their soda cans so he can recycle them. He was warned not to talk to kids, and that if anyone saw him, you know, would be held to pay. So this, like, you know, asshole who's watching him, who threatened him last time, rounds up the troops and, like, starts hounding him down the street in this, like, very, you know, pulse pounding sort of, you know, like Brett does not hesitate, takes off his shoes and just, like, runs, like,
yeah,
in a way,
like,
that,
like, Tom Cruise at Mission Impossible, just, like, very determined running.
It was so good. Cause I'm like, that's what I always want people to do when they're getting, like, chased down the street, is I'm like, get off the road. Why are you running straight down the road? He just, like, veers off, goes in the grass. And we find out sort of what that duffel bag was full of, which is guns, not a body.
I mean, he knows they're going to intercept him at the house, and he kind of almost wants them to.
Yeah. It seems like he's just spoiling for a fight. And so, like, which is, like, understandable, giving everything that he's been through, right? So we see him rig a bomb. We see him get his guns ready. He's got a tattered American flag as his, like, window covering. And these assholes all circle the house, and they're calling him out. And Wes and Hayes roll up. This is the end of the episode. We're doing in the middle of our episode. I apologize. And Wes and Hayes roll up. And then it goes, cuts to black as, like, the lead bully is, like, kicking down the door, and we hear an explosion sound. So
what does it say on the mine? It's like, face toward enemy or whatever. That could be the name of the episode, but yeah. There's got to be one big action sequence in True Detective, like there was in the first season with that extended take, and then
yeah,
there was something in season two, I don't remember, but
there was a big shootout with, like, all the detectives. Yeah,
that's right. You know, and I would guess that we're not just gonna end with, I mean, we're gonna see the follow-up of past that explosion. I would think
something we know, and some, you know, we'll you know, it's really pronounced this time in the 1990 is that Roland West got shot at some point in 1980, and he's got a terrible limp in this episode. So, you know, just that's the thing to keep in mind. This feels like a good point to go to our interview with Brett Woodard.
Hi, Joanna.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. Very excited to do this with you.
Oh, I'm so appreciative of your time. I think your performance on the show is amazing. I'm so happy to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
You know, one of, I think, the most compelling scenes of the entire show so far has been that interrogation room scene that you have a little early on in the season. I was wondering if you could talk about the energy that you brought to that scene and what that was like to shoot.
Yeah, that was extraordinary for me. You know, coming back and just trying to find yourself, you know, sadly for my character, he never does. He never does sort of really find himself. But that scene in particular, even Jeremy, the director for that episode, he said, this is like one of my favorite scenes in the whole season.
You have such a rich CV. You've done so much good work, but I'm wondering, the way you talk about the Woodard character, is there something in this character, in the nuance and the layers, that you haven't had an opportunity to play in the past?
Definitely. I think what, you know, there was actually a comment on I think it was Instagram. Somebody wrote about the scene, and they actually said something incredibly nuanced about how Woodard fits inside the show, but also fits inside the kind of writing and representation that exists in Hollywood for indigenous characters. And she said, "What's beautiful about the scene and the character is that he exists, you know, with a kind of full dimensionality. The fact of his nativeness is sort of a background issue to his humanity. Like, we don't see native characters as often as we should in our media. And the sort of the complexity and nuance of the writing normalize him. And in a weird way, it decentralized his nativeness, and we just cared about him as a person. So I thought that was a really wonderful comment, because again, you know, the writing and, you know, the work that I was, you know, trying to achieve, you know, with Mahershala and Stephen, every time we did the scene, and we did the scene a lot, it just kept deepening.
And then his native identity is such a key part of what happens next with the townspeople who are bullying him, who are ostracizing him. So how do you as a performer sort of calibrate wanting to decentralize that native identity to make that the background of his character, and then also engage in this very real racial persecution that's part of his story?
Right. I think with contemporary characters, contemporary native characters, and really, you know, any one from a community of color, you know, our presence inside these narratives often invites an examination of race, the ostracizing or othering of our communities, and what I think Nick did so beautifully with Woodard and Hayes is that he sort of created this this dialogue, a dialogue almost like insiders, like an inside dialogue between two people who've experienced you know, the systemic kind of racism that you're talking about, the sort of societal pressures and isolations that we experience as marginalized, so-called marginalized communities. And in fact, it kind of enriches how characters can be explored. You know, very often, and in the case of Woodard, the examination of violence in our society towards, you know, our communities is omnipresent. It's been ongoing. I think the incident in D.C. just recently sort of helps clarify that for people who may not be aware of it. So in a really striking way, when our characters are introduced inside these kinds of narratives, inside these stories, it gives audiences a chance to immerse themselves in our lived experience.
I did want to ask you about that, because the first time I watched this episode, it was actually before the incident in DC with Nathan Phillips and the Covington High kids. And the Brett Woodard story is so upsetting to watch regardless, but then to watch it in light of the conversation, the national conversation we're having around what happened to Nathan Phillips, it hits even harder for me, at least as a viewer. And I'm just wondering what you're hoping everyone who's following that national conversation will get out of watching this episode and what happens to Woodard in it.
Mm. That's a complex question. Thank you. I think one of the things that I face as an artist, and I've been in the industry a long time, is that I have a very important role, because of the issues of erasure within our media, within history, the framing of our experience as Indigenous people. We are excluded from conversations. Our characters are absent from narratives, specifically contemporary ones. And so as an actor, I'm very cognizant and proud of the fact that I've, you know, I represent my communities and, you know, the way I look, you know, how I'm cast often brings our presence, you know, our survival front and center. And I think watching what happened, you know, this past weekend, clarifies in a really ugly way, how this erasure continues to affect us. You know, I know, for example, Savannah Guthrie brought one of the boys from that school onto her program. And my response, of course, immediately was like, wow. Did they actually erase Nate's experience? The experience of a community that he represented, an elder, you know, again, so, you know, on multiple levels, ageist, racist, however you wanted to describe it, we were removed from the conversation. We were removed from the conversation about what happened. So in light of that, I feel doubly important, like doubly committed to continuing to represent, continuing to be part of these narratives, you know, sort of reinforcing this idea for ourselves. And we've never gone away.
I wanted to ask you, you know, a little more broadly, what you think Nick is trying to say in the season of True Detective about, I mean, PTSD is a thing that exists both for Mahershala's character and for yourself and for a number of other men in this time that we're exploring in the show. And I'm wondering, you know, for the way in which PTSD manifests with Woodard and with what you have to convey, you know, what some of the research that you did or some of the thoughts that you had around that particular strain.
Definitely. You know, I've been fortunate actually to have played soldiers previous to, you know, this season. And I've done a lot of research. You know, I think people may not be aware, but Indigenous communities, both in Canada and in the United States, the number the percentage of our people that serve is extremely high. Like, it's a very, very high sort of percentage of people who serve. So PTSD has manifested itself in our communities in a number of ways. So I think my research, unfortunately, includes, you know, experiences of family, experiences of friends. And as an artist, that I'm really, as an actor, I'm really keenly interested in sort of diving as deeply as I can into the worlds of the characters I play. The research that I've done on PTSD is, like, pretty stunning. Like, it's shocking to me, right? And how it manifests itself is profound. Like, it's an incredibly complex condition. And so, you know, it's present all throughout the whole season. Like, you know, when I'm watching Mahershala and he's so brilliant, I see this kinds of issues that Woodard's facing. I see it inside Mahershala's character, inside the detective. And I think Nick writes that really beautifully. There are these kind of scary gaps and spaces inside these characters that he's written that allow the sort of complex experience, the dislocation, the trauma to sort of be experienced within the flow of dialogue, within the flow of action. As we know, you know, with Woodard, his isolation within the community, his isolation from his own family, sort of drives him further and further towards, I guess we'll call it, a breaking point. And of course, the violence that exists, I think, throughout the whole season, there's a thread of it. when it explodes, as everyone will see, it's not surprising. You know, those spaces in the writing, those spaces in the character's journey, you know, it was almost like landmines. And we had this sense of foreboding, like, what is going to happen with these men? And I actually don't know what happens beyond the arc of my character. So I'm actually with you, rest of the audience. Like, I do not know what's going to happen. I don't know anything. Actually, I read your article, and I've been reading all the articles, and I'm just trying to sleuth it out for myself.
Right.
But yeah, I think PTSD and playing soldiers is an incredible honor. And I hope that work, the sort of rigor that I try to bring to those performances, honor that complex experience.
There's some extremes in this season of the violence that you talked about. But I'm wondering, there's this thing with Woodard where we watch him get pushed around, and there's this thing inside of him where he is just not going to take that. And I'm wondering if that pushback is at all cathartic for you personally to play, that sort of that strain that Woodard has of like, no, you are not allowed to put me in this box and to push me around.
It was gratifying. Yeah. I will say, I don't mean to harp on it, but I think it was really interesting when we think back to, you know, last weekend. There was a distance between the groups that were, you know, in conflict. And interestingly, it was when an elderly gentleman, you know, when this elder appeared, that the physical space was broken down in the interaction that followed. And I think to myself, it's like, well, they weren't afraid of this older guy, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I think about Woodard's journey, the townspeople weren't afraid of him either, right?
Right.
And when they pushed him too far, I won't call it resurgent, but it felt important that he make a stand. And that resistance, that force of will, the violence that explodes from him, was strangely cathartic.
Yeah.
I'll admit that.
I can imagine. Absolutely. And then I wanted to ask you, and thank you again so much for your time. I'm really loving talking to you. Did you have any either personal inspirations or fictional inspirations for the character of Woodard, either that you talked to Nick about or you just came to on your own?
Where did Woodard come from?
Yeah.
I think he came from a lot of different places. I run a theater company in Toronto called Signal Theater, and we presented a piece called A Soldier's Tale a number of years ago. At the National Arts Centre in Canada. And it was all about soldiers, and it was all about the aftermath of war and how it plays on soldiers and their families. And for me, the thing that allowed me to sort of crack Woodard open was this sense of loss of family. So I think, you know, he said, you have kids? And he's like, yeah, I've got kids. You know, like, so I know what this experience is like. And I have two beautiful daughters. And the thought of losing my family allowed me just, you know, as a father, as a husband, to sort of drop into this, I guess, place, a place of, like, it's emotionally devastating, right, to lose someone. So I feel that that's sort of how I got inside of him, this sense of grief, this grief that sort of permeates his entire life. To me, one of the saddest things he said, I think Hayes asks him, do you have a family? And he was surprised that the question came up. And Woodard says, I miss being someone that way.
Yeah.
So in a way, he's grieving the loss of who he was as a human being, as a father, as a husband. He goes, I miss being a person that way. that broke my heart when I read it. So that's, I think that's where he came from.
Yeah, for us, you know, we were discussing this last episode, episode 3, I think it is, where Woodard has this encounter with the men of the town, and he says, you know, he says, I got kids, and someone says, no, you don't. And we were just like, that it was the craziest thing for me to hear, because it's just, as you say, erasure of this man's existence. Like, how would you ever say to someone, no, you don't have kids? Like, what is, you know, I know that Woodard's, you know, children don't live around him, but just that like repudiation of identity really bothered us when we watched it.
Yeah. And it was disturbing when we did the scene, you know, like those stuntmen were incredible. Those actors were incredible, but, it was ugly. You know, we had to sort of find the ugliness of that moment.
Yeah.
But afterwards, like, you know, we need to hug it out, because I mean, nobody likes to go there. And if you do, you're not well.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's, you know, some of the lines of his journey. And of course, you know, the scene with those girls, on the side of the road. And, every time I think about Woodard, I get sad. I have to admit,
yeah.
Because that arc was really, really affecting to me. You know, I think I filmed my last scene, you know, for the show in August, and, just watching it again, you know, like I'm watching these episodes for the first time with y'all, mm-hmm. you know, like with everybody.
Right.
To immerse myself in that world, I'm brought back immediately to all of the violence that we've seen across our land. You know, Charlottesville, everywhere. You know, there's an ugliness that's always been present. The children, you know, at the border.
Yeah.
You don't have to look far, and you don't have to look hard to see that we have a long, long way to go. And you know, as I watch this season, and to me, the pacing is so beautiful, and the sort of the I love your description of the show. There's collateral damage everywhere, and as we sift through it, as we have to, you know, sift through these people's lives. Yeah, I think we see a portrait of ourselves that is a bit too uncomfortable.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate your incredible work on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Joanna. I love the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
I've been listening.
Thank you for listening.
And absolutely. And of course, I can't wait to see the next episode.
I know.
Dying.
It's going to be huge. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Joanna. Take care.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
So let's hop over to 1990, and we've got another like classic Wayne and Amelia interaction, which you, as you say, is like Milchian. Like he comes home, he says he's on the case, he's excited about it. Amelia hurls all these like very demeaning things to him. Wayne checks in on the kids. They go upstairs to the bedroom to like continue the fight, and they, you know, the fight escalates, and then they have sex. The line reading that stood out the most for me is like, you know, stop demeaning me. And she's like, or what? He goes, or I'll cry.
Stop shit talking me.
Yeah.
And she's like, or what? He's like, I'm going to cry.
Or I'm going to cry.
Then and then he does.
Yeah.
It's such an interestingly performed scene. I think for
really?
Jogo, but like really, but Ali is really doing something. And it, you know, the character is written in such a way. He never quite reacts to things the way you expect him to.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really nice to see a character like this who is undoubtedly haunted, if not, I mean, certainly more by war, who is haunted and hates the stuff he has to see at work, who is a drinker, you know, to some extent, not a full blown alcoholic, but like, you know, these are tropes we've seen before, and yet he has these bursts of warmth and real humanity and vulnerability that, and not just vulnerability, all, you know, someone haunted by war is pretty vulnerable, but stated vulnerability. He can say it, you know, I appreciate, as much as I appreciate the friendship, the genuine friendship between Roland and Wayne, I really appreciate the way that, especially in this scene, Wayne is drawn so fully.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also this part that, reminds me of, you know, something that Woodard said in an earlier episode where Wayne says, like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what you want me to do. I'll do whatever you want. And he says, just give me the more order. Give me the order, Major, is what he says to her. And it's this idea that, like, soldiers don't know how to stop being soldiers once they leave the war, right? And like, Woodard said something similar about like, I miss being a person like that. Like, that's sort of him talking about before the war, but this idea of like, what do you do with a soldier who is trained to take orders and then has to like steer their own ship later? And so he's like, just boss me around and I'll do whatever. I'll do it. Like, I really liked that little thing thrown in there. So, they have sex. I enjoy that she keeps this like amazing full length 90s denim dress on the whole time.
Yeah. Shirt dress,
is a beautiful shirt dress. And the other thing I want to mention is like Carmen Ejogo does an amazing, a lot of people in the show do amazing jobs with the accents. She's almost entirely amazing, but it's always fun when like an actor just slightly slips up. She says vicissitudes in a way that sounds very British.
In her defense, that word's fucking impossible to say normally by anybody.
It's true. But she, you know, she's British. So like, you know, she says this thing and that, I mean, it's so cutting. She says vicissitudes and then he like barely has time to register his blank expression before she says, look it up. Like, it's just so shitty. Like, it's a real, and it, but like, it is, here's, I know exactly your button. I'm going to push it right now. Here we go. So, and then we get, you know, there's not much more to the 90s plotline. We get, the reopening of the task force. We get a whole little avalanche of clues from the 1990s reopening the task force in terms of like Lucy's OD, that Dan, the cousin Dan is still a person of interest and nobody knows where he is. That they were upset sort of with how the 80s case sort of ended suddenly in a way where they didn't feel like they got to complete their investigation. And Hayes feels that more than West.
We don't yet know what that means, right? We haven't.
We don't. Yeah. And we should say really quickly that, the Attorney General Kent comes in and they basically like tell West and Hayes that the purpose of reopening the case is to vindicate their previous conclusion, not to find the new killer. And like, you're going to play ball with that, right? And basically like holding his threat over Hayes or this promise of like, hey, maybe if you play ball, you can get back on major crimes. And when they leave, Wayne says, we're not going to do any of that shit, right? And West says, I hadn't planned on it, in his like convivial buddy way, but then also gets this interesting look on his face because we know he's more inclined to play ball than Hayes is. So that will be a question of who will be falling in line with what the Attorney General wants, what the real interest is in reopening the case. We know that Wayne wants to find out what actually happened. That's his primary interest. So, there we go. And then, you know, the last thing I'll say about that whole like reopening of the case is that, you know, Wayne's like, let's not say that Julie's alive yet, just in case like whoever wanted her dead in 1980 maybe would still want her dead. So let's just keep that information to keep her safe. The detectives go to visit the Salisaw cops and we find out, Wayne finds out that Amelia called him her ex-husband. He looks very unhappy about that. And then Wayne looks at CCTV for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And this is where Richard and I admit that like the screeners that we got had no footage on that CCTV until the very end, when you see a girl, a very 90s looking girl, in my opinion, look up at the camera and Wayne is like, that would be Julie if Julie is indeed there. So there we go. It's like the state of the marriage right now and the state of the case in the 90s. And that's basically what we get from the 90s, right?
Yeah.
All right. And then we get the 2015s, which is like super interesting. So right up from the top of the 2015s, I'm going to ask you, Richard, do you think Henry is having sex with Eliza? Because that,
fully.
It's definitely what Wayne thinks.
Yeah. And I like the way that they're kind of subtle about it. And I'm like, what could that mean? Like, what are there implications for the show or for the story? Or is it just kind of like a funny, interesting other little side mystery detail? But I like the way he's like, if you happen to see him, you know, and stuff
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. And the
like,
two wine glasses. Yeah.
Like, yeah. So I think that's definitely happening.
Yeah. And something I didn't realize until after we recorded last week's episode is that, anytime I say Henry and Eliza, it's like, it's a little My Fair Lady thing kicks up for me. So I just wanted to stay on brand. And
do you want to do the rest of the episode in a Cockney accent?
So that's the thing about, I also don't know that we knew that Henry is a cop. Did I miss that in one of the first three episodes?
Oh, I don't remember if we knew that beforehand, actually.
I think we didn't. And if we know that he is now. And there's an idea that, like, you know, Wayne is like, you obviously have some investigators working on this, like, case. You've got information, is what he says to Eliza. You've got information that I need. I want that info. And she's like, are you working this case? He's like, no. But, like, yeah, he definitely is. Mm-hmm. The question is, I don't think this is the case, but the question is Henry working the case for Eliza? Like, is he doing any investigation and providing her with the info since she's, like, sleeping with a cop? Whose dad originally worked on the case. Like, I don't know. It's a question. But the big clue that she dropped for Wayne and their interaction is that Cousin Dan's body was found in a drain quarry. Dan, Lucy's cousin, who went missing in 90 after resurfacing. So we know they're going to find Dan in 1990. We're going to see what his 1990 wig looks like. And then he's going to disappear again until they drain a quarry in South Missouri and find him. His body there. So,
and presumably his wig.
Yes. Hopefully his wig will also have been preserved in that quarry. She's Eliza says very conveniently, I can't show you all my cards right now. So that
because it's only episode four. Yeah.
So that it will be parceled out for the audience. And we should say that Wayne asked Henry to find Roland for him, that he hasn't seen Roland in a long time. And he says he needs his memory, in order to figure out like what happened. And then we get this like last scene of Wayne in the study. And it's another like ghost scene, very haunting. He mutters some things and I'm just going to like recap them really quickly. He says, we found the footage, learned about Julie Purcell and the Grouper Street Kids. I Googled that, got no hits. So we'll find out what the Grouper Street Kids are when True Detective decides to tell us.
That was, my band, that I had in the 90s. Yeah. Yeah. It was just like, we didn't get very far, but it was sort of like Call Me Bad-esque. We had fun.
Oh, nice. Did you perform every song in a Cockney accent or no?
Well, that was the whole thing. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Color Me Bad, but Cockney. Great. Yeah. Okay. Grouper Street.
Color Me Bad.
Richard Lawson and the Grouper Street Kids. Yeah. Julie Purcell on the drums. And then what we find out in this, little monologue he has is that he's talking to Becca. He keeps saying like your mom and I lost you to Walmart and stuff like that. So he's talking to his daughter. And then eerily the ghosts of these like Vietnam fighters come like sort of crowding into the room.
Which is a very theater moment. I mean, like I could see that being a little bit more effective on stage perhaps, but it was nonetheless effective because it's the show getting real magical realism.
I think the heads down, like the hats and the heads down, was pretty effective. But he says, we found the brown car. Who was it? So we know in 1990, some point they will find that like nice brown car that we know is a clue, but they don't, but he still doesn't know whose it was. Either he's forgotten or they never find out. And then he says, I felt like maybe I made you all sick, like I poisoned you. This seems like he's talking about his family there. Maybe I decided I didn't want to stay alive without your mother. This is the suicidal thoughts that you mentioned. And then we should mention that, like, among the Vietnam fighters, I'm presuming these are the people that he killed in the war. And among them pointedly is a white guy in what looks to me very much like 90s, like a 90s suit, mm-hmm. a 90s tie, a 90s suit with his head down with the rest of like the Vietnamese fighters. And he,
and like, it could just be people he saw die. I don't know. I kind of assumed it was killed, but there were other troops there that didn't look like Viet Cong troops. And I don't know. Like maybe they were Aravian. I don't know if he was would have killed them.
That's true. There's like there's guys with you know helmets on and stuff like that, not hats. Right. That's true. Yeah. So maybe not his kills. Maybe people he saw die. But you know these are ghosts that haunt him of deaths, dead people. And he says I need to tell Roland about O'Brien. So that's cousin Dan. I need to talk to Roland. And then I really like the part where he like just holds out his finger and wags it at the like murmuring dead people to quiet them.
Yeah.
And then he's like looking at the window. He sees a car out on the street that like this seems like a very paranoid sort of like, is someone watching me kind of thing. He's talking to his tape recorder about what the model of the car is. And then he turns to the ghost. He's like, do they even make Mercurys anymore? Which is like this like weird funny part of this really like haunting moment, and that's the end of the 2015. Yeah. That's not the where the episode ends, but that's where
the finger wag could almost kind of evoke the thing across the table with Amelia,
oh.
which is like, do you want to brush fingers? You know,
yeah,
it feels nice. And then another thing about the 2015 thing, and then we can move on, is he says to Eliza that the thing that happened in 1990 haunts him the most.
Yeah.
Right. And so we don't really know where that's all going. So I thought that was kind of interesting because I feel like we're probably getting to a point. We're now halfway through the season where the 1980 plot line is maybe reaching its end.
It seems close. Like we're opening the 1990 case and we're maybe closing the 1980 case. Yeah.
Right.
So that's that, you know, and that's a kind of fun idea to think of it in terms of waves. Like the first wave is 1980 heavy, then maybe 1990 heavy, and then 2015 heavy, possibly. Yep. So that is the episode. We're going to talk really quickly about like one fun theory thing that's kicked up before we get to that spoiler section. So this is something that like, I don't know if I'll be able to explain in podcast form. I'm used to like writing about these theories more than talking about them. So we'll see if I am able to do this without like links to show you guys. But, you know, Nick Pizzolatto has been posting some True Detective stuff on his Instagram. So if you're interested in like some of his thoughts about the episodes and stuff like that, in addition to some of the inside the episode interviews he does for HBO, this is a good source. And he posted this photo of Rachel McAdams in season two, the much maligned season two. And he says, one day I'll admit the story of season two was about four people gradually realizing they're already dead. And one of them makes it back to life. The Black Rose is the Bardo. And then he said, I said too much. This is his caption on a photo of Rachel McAdams on his Instagram. You can go find it if you want to. The Bardo is the name of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And if you want to read more about this, there is a very long and great like Reddit theory from season two where someone was like, season two of True Detective is the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And that Reddit commenter, I was sort of digging through all of this, and that Reddit commenter put that link underneath Nick Pizzolatto's Instagram post. Like, I wrote about this when you made season two, basically. And Nick Pizzolatto faved it. So like, you know, it's, I feel like it's an interesting thing worth reading. So you might want to read that whole, Reddit thread if you've got the time and you're interested. The title of it is True Detective Season 2 in the Eastern Book of the Dead. The poster is Honest_Richard. That's Richard Lawson's Reddit poster name, by the way, obviously.
Yep, obviously.
So basically this idea, I mean, it's kind of complicated to dive too much into, but I think it might be relevant to season three, especially what we're seeing with, Wayne and the ghosts. And I'll just say really quickly that this idea of the Tibetan Book of the Dead is that like when you die, there's a whole cycle that you go through, where you like, you die, which is the bardo, the moment of death. And then there's the bardo, which is the experiencing of reality, which features experience of visions or various Buddha forms or the nearest approximations of which one is capable. And then there's the bardo of rebirth, which features karmically impelled hallucinations, which eventually result in rebirth, you know, typically sexy, actually, apparently. This is me paraphrasing the Tibetan Book of the Dead Wikipedia page. Anyway, this idea, I don't think we're talking about literal death and rebirth necessarily. But one thing to think about is if you've ever seen the film Jacob's Ladder, starring Tim Robbins. That is a book that is very much about the Tibetan East, the Book of the Dead, which is Tim Robbins' character goes through this whole thing in the film, and spoiler alert for Jacob's Ladder, which came out like in the early 90s or late 80s. It turns out that he actually died in Vietnam, and everything that he experiences in that film is his like processing that information. His road to the afterlife is this mass hallucination of his post-Vietnam experience. I don't think it's coincidence that like the idea of being a Vietnam vet haunted by the people that you may have killed or may have seen die in Vietnam is part of this episode. And this is a theme that is of such great interest to Nick Pizzolatto. So perhaps he's doing this again, this idea of like time being a flat circle that we learn in season one, this idea of like three phases in this season of like 1990, 1980, 2015, this idea that we've already talked about on this podcast about liminal spaces, about people talking about, feeling like, you know, you're asleep, but you can't wake up, or like, have you ever been in a place where like you wanted to leave, but you couldn't at the same time? And this idea that Richard pointed out, this like trio of people in this episode who talk about wanting to die. So just put this in your mind, of this idea of not like literal death and rebirth, but maybe this idea of psychic death and rebirth. Like maybe Wayne is trying to bring himself back to life. By solving this cathartic solving of this case, this revisiting of old ghosts is a way for him to either like accept his death or bring himself back to life in some way. I don't know. That's my best attempt at doing like Reddit theory on podcasts. So, there you go.
Yeah. Go, you know, don't take Joanna's word for it. Go read a book, read it. look it up. It's in a book.
Look it up. It's in a book of Reading Rainbow. All right. So that is, this is the end of our spoiler free discussion. We're
going to figure out what sound we're going to play to signify a spoiler. I mean, I can't, the licensing for the Groove of Street Kids band is so tied up in legal stuff. So we can't use one of those. I'd love for you guys to hear it.
To honor the hog heat of Sharp Objects, shouldn't it be like something about the chicken line?
There you go. Chickens.
Yeah. Chickens and some sort of music. We'll figure it out. Dave,
chickens,
our editor.
And Mamie Gummer saying, everything you touch turns to shit.
Great. Great. All right. So that is going to lead us in. Prepare for the chicken sound. And then what follows here after that is enter at your own risk.
Everything you touch turns to shit.
Okay, if you're here, you definitely
your family.
Olive Garden. This episode brought to you by Olive Garden. No, I'm just kidding.
I wish.
This section is where we're going to talk about a very compelling theory that involves a behind the scenes photo that HBO themselves put out. But, you know, we just want to make sure that you feel like you want to know about this behind the scenes photo. And you can Google this if you like. We're only going to be able to describe it to you. But basically the behind the scenes photo is of an actress in a long, like long white dress, looks like a little old fashioned, a little Quakery, sitting in the cave where they found Will's body. And it's like a scene, like where they're setting up a shot. This actress is like waiting to be shot, basically. And you see the crew around her. That same actress is seen in a photo in episode 3 in the background as Roland is walking around the Hoyt Foods, office. And so she's there in the same dress with like a creepy, like slightly JonBenet looking little like blonde girl on her lap. So we can reasonably conclude that that photo behind Roland in the Hoyt Foods office is, the daughter of Mr. Hoyt. I forget. I don't know if we know his first name, who we learned in episode 3 that the reason that this Ozark family children's outreach charity exists, is because Hoyt's granddaughter went missing. So presumably the little girl in this photo who's sitting on her mom's lap, you know, is the girl in question who went missing. So the theory that people put together by putting together that photo and the behind the scenes cave shot is that the true culprit here is Hoyt's daughter who took Julie, to replace her own daughter who went missing. And we get some info in this, you know, like this mention of like maybe the, you know, the white woman that we've seen around is her, this idea that there's like a car that looks too nice to be of the neighborhood, this brown sedan that looks too nice. You know, a Hoyt heiress might be driven around in a too nice brown car. This idea of a black man helping her with a scar, like we get info in this episode about like the chicken line being a source for injury. And Wayne even says in this episode, like, let's cross-reference workplace injuries with the list we have from Hoyt Foods. So like Wayne in theory is on the right track here. And this idea of this aunt, this mysterious aunt who is, you know, plying Will and Julie with toys in the woods, may have wanted Julie. We find out in this episode 4, that like, Wayne says something about like, I have a feeling it's all about the girl, and maybe Will died by accident, like trying to.
Which Amelia says, do you think it could be an accident? Which made me think like, was that Amelia being like,
right,
kind of confessing in a way, being like, I didn't mean to do it.
Right.
But like, but that, I don't know, this photo thing, like, that sounds pretty.
It's hard to figure out another reason why Hoyt's daughter would be in that cave for a shot, other than the fact that we should say this episode proves that we're going to get like probably more and more hallucinations. So you never know what hallucinations we're going to get. But that being said, like, why would, if Wayne is hallucinating something, why would it be Hoyt's daughter in the cave? Unless she was the murderer.
And so. Also, if a Hoyt executive knocked up Lucy, maybe it's not only the daughter's stolen daughter, it's her sister.
Right, exactly. Like, or yeah, it could be.
So maybe they feel a sense of ownership over her.
Sister, daughter.
These lowlifes not raising this kid well.
Children should laugh, you know. Don't you think?
Children should laugh.
Yeah, exactly.
That's actually the first single of Gruber's Kids.
Oh, is it spelled S-H-U-D like it is in the ransom note?
Yeah, we were kind of dumb and just didn't know it. But yeah, it's a great song.
Children should laugh, mate.
Hello.
Hello.
We're the Gruber Street Kids.
All right. So that is it. That's what we think is probably the most compelling theory right now. It feels a little like not very sportsmanlike to get it from a behind the scenes photo that Reddit dug up, but we don't want to like pretend we don't know about it. So,
but they did release it, right? HBO did put it out in the world.
HBO put it out there. So that was their perhaps dumb mistake. I don't know. Who knows?
It's not some telephoto lens thing. It's,
no, a drone did not take this photo. So
the only other theory is that maybe they were doing a cast photo at the end of with everyone, and they decided morbidly to do it in the cave.
Everyone crowd up in the devil's den. Here we go. Jeez. Posing Will and a sort of Weekend at Bernie's thing. All right. I don't want to talk about this anymore. Let us tell people where they can find our work.
My work is at vf.com and at Rylaws. And until next week, I'm going to be trying to dig up some Gruber Street Kids cassettes because I know I have them and I really want you people to hear them. Joanna, where are you going to be?
I will be at vanityfair.com, or you can find me, I think I already said this before, I'm going to say it again, on the chicken line. All right. And this edit, this episode was edited and produced by the great Dave Gonzalez. And we will see you next week.
Cheerio.
Have you sat back over the last 2 decades and thought about the sheer number of fatalities surrounding this case?
Can I tell you a secret?
That you man killed.
What happened?
Those kids. Our kids. Why? My whole brain's a bunch of missing pieces. That's when it all started. Panic.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified. Available on all podcast platforms.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.